Good morning, everyone. Welcome to week three. I know it's travel time, so some people are away. Oops. A lot of people are away. Just a couple of housekeeping announcements before we start. First of all, just two things. This Friday night, for those that are interested, we have a mindful minion at 6 p.m. here. And next week is the last one of the series, which is the 5th of July, and then we take a two-week break for school holidays. And the new session will start on the 26th of July, and I'll announce the topic next week, please God. Also, at the end of today, we're going to stop a few minutes early and do what we always do every Thursday, last Thursday of June, which is to draw the raffle. A bit of a raffle. Okay, so first of all, a little bit of review. So we've been talking about the mindset of pendulum, the pendulum syndrome, which is that a lot of people tend to work in boxes and can only do one thing at a time, one extreme or the other, similar to what society does. Society swings from one extreme to another. And we talked about this at length, that the goal, of course, is to develop what we call tiferet, which is the middle line, where we're not locked into one personality or another, we're not locked into chesed or gevura, but we're able to move away from ourselves and look for the truth, look what is needed, rather than look what we need to feel or the way we impulsively or instinctively feel, but move away from ourselves and look at what the situation requires, what the call of the hour or the call of the moment is, and being able to strike that balance. And as we explained last week, that tiferet, when we talk about balance, which is difficult, because normally balance requires a move away from our own ego, but we explained that it's not just a compromise. When we mean balance, we don't mean to dilute the one, the right or the left, or the chesed or the gevura, but often what tiferet actually means is a combination of two extremes, the ability to actually have a high dose of both, and to bring them together and work with them together for the sake of what is needed, what is moral, what is true, and what is effective. So last week we also gave some examples, and we also explained that when we take one extreme, when we have a goal or we have a personality, and we take one extreme and we're unable to achieve that middle tiferet, that bringing together the extremes, what ends up happening is we end up undermining the very goal we set out to be. So extreme kindness results in lack of kindness. And what we did last week is we gave a couple of examples, just to run through them very quickly again. We talked about the concept of respectful conflict, where sometimes disagreeing is a form of acceptance. And sometimes when people are very obsessed with acceptance and tolerance, but to an extreme, they become unable to tolerate anyone who has a different opinion, because they can't reconcile the fact that we need to accept diversity, but yet the other person disagrees with me. So we gave some examples of that. The second example we gave was the concept of gossip, where someone who stays away from gossip, which is a very noble thing to do, but sometimes we need to be able to gossip, and that's an opposite personality, where we have to share information with someone for the sake of marriage or the sake of a business deal or whatever the case is. And when we don't, because we're so extreme on staying away from not talking negatively, we end up being negative because we end up hurting the other person. And then finally, we told a story of, but really it's about a child, but it really goes to all relationships, about the story of the principal that had to expel a child, and the Chazon Ish, the great Lithuanian rabbi in Israel, told him if it will affect the whole school, if he doesn't, he may, which is a harsh thing to do, but at the same time he has to have the extreme kindness, and he had to make provisions and set aside time to learn with that child individually and to lift him, and it was very, very effective. It was a combination of two personality attributes at the same time, extreme harshness but extreme love at the same time, which became the effective solution. Okay. So today what I want to do is develop it a little bit and explain and go through some other examples which are examples about this whole idea of the pendulum and tiferet and so on, but relate ultimately to the way we live and the everyday-to-day human experience. So the first thing I want to talk about is this idea. Equality versus authority. Now, what do I mean, and what's it got to do with the pendulum concept? So, in ancient times, or not so long ago, the world used to live pretty much in a very, very big way in a world of inequality, right? Which often meant that relationships were affected, societies were affected, and sometimes we had people or societies or communities relating to each other either in a very suppressive, authoritarian way or in a very disrespectful way. So we had things like abuse in relationships, abuse of children, which were swept under the carpet and sort of allowed to continue with no one having the strength to stand up and so on. We had slavery in a very extreme ways, harshness. We had apartheid. We had in education also, it was very, very much like that. Parents often were very, very strong and overly strong with their children in a very sort of authoritarian, controlling way. Teachers with students sometimes. So there was this very big culture of control on authority, which had its place, but it didn't. It often landed up in protecting or hiding or supporting or being very, very negative, very, very oppressive at sometimes in societies and in relationships, right? Now today, the world, which is a good thing, essentially, has moved away from that, right? So we have much, much greater awareness today. So we live in a society today where society has moved towards a much greater degree of equality, a much greater degree of rejection of abuse and control, or negative control. We've moved much, much more into a culture of empowerment, where we try to empower people rather than controlling them, right? Because we know that controlling others is a bad thing. We're not supposed to control the people, we're supposed to control ourselves. And all of these sort of good things have come into which are very, very good and very, very positive. However, like everything, we tend to suffer from a pendulum syndrome. So, besides the good results that have come out of this type of move away from negative control and away from inequality, we've actually resulted as a society in some very, very negative things, right? And I want to go through some of them so we understand, and then we'll try to understand what is actually the goal. How do we apply to Tiferet, to this whole concept, and this idea of balance, right? So, for example, one of the things that's resulted in the obsession towards and the pursuit of everyone being equal, for example, is that there's very little respect for authority. That's just the culture of the world that we live in. Just recently, in France, there was a rally of some sort of event, public event to do with the Second World War. The president of France was there, Emmanuel Macron. I don't know about him a lot. I don't know much about him at all, to tell you the truth, but it's not really relevant, because what happened at this particular event was he was moving along the masses, and he moved along a line, and there were some couple of teenagers there. And apparently he has a nickname called Manu or something. And some kid said to him, "How you doing, Manu?" So he got upset, and he scolded him in public. It's on television, on video. And he said, "That's not a respectful thing to do. You don't do that. It's an official ceremony, it's a public thing. You just don't do that." And as I said, I don't know much about... I don't follow French politics a lot, more Australian-American and Israeli, but otherwise I don't know much about politics in other countries. I don't know much about his character or anything, but it's irrelevant. He is the president of the country, and it's wrong. It's such, how do we land up in such a world where people do this kind of thing, where a kid can talk to a president like that? So it reminded me of my own, I think I've shared this with you once before, but it reminded me of my own awakening in this, my own experience with this once, where when I came to Australia, actually next week will be 30 years since we arrived here, 6th of July. Yeah. So when we first arrived, I was pretty much fresh out of yeshiva. So my former tertiary years, say as a single boy, I spent in yeshiva. 2 years in Morristown, a couple of years in Morristown, New Jersey. I was for a short time as a student in Melbourne. Back in Brooklyn and so on. Taught for a year in Morristown Yeshiva and then came to Australia. So a couple of years later, I enrolled in and that's when I did my sort of educational training. I enrolled in a course initially for special education. It was about dealing with children with learning difficulties. And the course was run, it was once a week out in University of New South Wales and far away. And the course was run by a, I don't remember who she was a very, very big professor, a giant in her field. Her name was Loretta Giocelli. She was actually amazing. Her lectures were fascinating. Her knowledge was amazing. Her connection with people in the field was incredible. And I was a married guy, I had a child, I had two children by then. And I went to this course, and it was obvious, it was a lot of people in the room. There was a lecture once a week, and it was like probably over 100 people. And once a week for a year. And it was obvious that many people had known her, known her already. And as the course was, like, I was used to a particular model, right? But we were in yeshiva. We never, ever referred to our teachers by their first name. It just didn't exist. The closest we'd come, some of the rabbis in yeshiva had a, because of like an endearment, they had such a nice relationship with the boys, we sometimes used their first name, but it was always prefaced by Reb. So like, you know, this would be like Reb Yankel or Reb someone, right? It was just, that's the way it was. Or Rabbi so-and-so, right? Using the surname. And it was just like, by me, it was just like a normal thing. I mean, I was a bit older than already, but like it was a normal thing. So I thought that you're supposed to address a Professor Giocelli. That was, if I were to ask a question, that's what I would do, right? And I'm saying this from there's a lot of people, a lot of them younger than me even. I wasn't that old then, I was very young. But and just referring to Loretta this, Loretta that, to me it was like a strange thing. Like you're going to somewhere. I mean, it's not such a terrible thing, but it was a symptom of something that was creeping up already in society. Like I was going to a course where I was learning from someone who had greater knowledge and greater skill and greater experience in a field, older than me. Greater skill and experience in the field, and it was just a normal thing to address with respect. And then I saw, no, that's not the way it works in regular society. And since then, that was like 25 years ago, but since then it's just gotten worse. But it's because it's all comes that fundamental now. One could argue whether it's absolutely necessary to use first name, not to use first name, that's a separate issue. But it is a little bit symptomatic of a culture that's become where everyone's just in the same boat, everyone's buddies, everyone's friends. And it's okay to do that, right? So it's like a sort of a decline of respect. And we do find that the whole idea of respect for authority is a big problem. The second thing that I think has come out of that whole shift, and that's the pendulum effect, is we've created a culture of entitlement. People are very, very entitled today. Now, you know, when things happen and the culture becomes prevalent, so... If you want to understand it properly, you always go to like a YouTube video, which makes fun of it in the extreme. So obviously this is, and I couldn't find it just in time to show you the video, but it is. I saw this a while ago, and it was very funny. Obviously it's exaggerated and so on, but it was just a very funny thing about a very young person going to a interview, a business interview. Some of you might have seen this, going to a job interview with someone who's obviously older, much more traditional. And it's an acting thing, obviously. And she's sitting there on an iPhone while he's talking, and he says to her, "Well, you know, you come to this company. What are your research skills? Do you can you?" And he lists a number of programs. She says, "No, I can't do any of that." So he says, "Well, how are you gonna find information?" She says, "Not a problem. I'll ask Siri." And Siri will always give you the answer. That's just the funny part of the way it starts. And then he says, "Okay, so you think you'll be ready to?" Think you'll be ready to start tomorrow at 8 o'clock. And she like has a shock. 8 o'clock? She says, "No, I'm up late and I do things and I go to Starbucks to get a coffee and then whatever the case is. And by the time I finish, I mean 10:30 is about right." And I don't know, a few other questions. And then he says, "Look, I don't think we're a match. Like, I don't think this is going to work. I don't think." So she says, "You know, why are you being so negative? The only thing I've heard so far is this negativity. I don't feel real safe now. Right now, is there an HR person to talk to?" So he says, "HR person to talk to? You actually don't work here yet. It's like no." She says, "Are you firing me?" She says, "I think I need to take a mental health day." He says, "But you don't work here to take off a day." She says, "Are you firing me?" And she goes, anyway, it's very funny, but it's a little bit. You can Google it. It's called funny job interview or something. But. It's a little bit true, unfortunately, right? Where there's, I think, and starting from children who are very, very young, who kind of expect a lot, feel very, very entitled, overblown in terms of rights, and rights is a good thing, because everyone does have rights, but like this overemphasis on what are my rights rather than what's my responsibility. And I think that's a little bit symptomatic, and it's a bit of a result of that positive swing of society to work to move away from control, move away from inequality to equality and respect, but it has a pendulum effect, and we have to be aware of that, right? Where it also shows up and is parenting. Sometimes dysfunctional parenting. So I don't know if you know, but there's some of you might be aware of this already, but there's a book that's becoming very, very popular. In the States and in England, it's a bestseller. I don't know if it's come how well it is. Someone alerted me to it, and I was in Melbourne, and I saw it in the airport, so I bought it. I haven't read it yet. I read a little bit of it. It's by a guy called Jordan Peterson. Now, he's a bit of a controversial fellow, I know, but because he's very right-wing, but he's a Canadian psychologist, and he's written a book called... He's a little bit controversial, but I don't mind quoting him because I saw Rabbi Sacks quotes him and he's in an article, so I thought I'm pretty safe ground, right? It's called 12 Rules for Life. An antidote. What does he call it? An antidote to chaos. His basic idea is we've gone mad today, and it's time to bring back some traditional values, and just to, like, you know, old-fashioned good fundamental values. And rule 5 in the book is, do not let your children do anything that makes you dislike them. Right? And he goes on to explain that we are now entering a culture, which is true. I mean, I talk to people about parenting and I do some parenting stuff, and I've seen this firsthand. We actually, parents are very scared of their children today. They indulge them. They don't teach them boundaries and rules. And partly, as Rabbi Sacks points out, who writes an article to it, he says that people are just as scared to say no, and we've... But he says not only about parenting, and it's 100% right, he says it's about a Western culture that has emerged, which Rabbi Sacks says, since the Beatles sang All You Need Is Love, that's what we landed up with. Because not actually, not that I know the song, but but that's what's happened. Like, no, it's not true all you need is love. Love is chesed. That's exactly the point. When you move only towards one extreme to the exclusion of the other, chesed and gvura can both be good and bad. Both were created by God, both have a purpose. And if we don't bring them together in a Tiferet mindset, you land up with chaos, right? It's not true that all you need is love. Love is extremely important. And even when you exercise harshness or firmness or discipline, it has to be with love, but it's still got to be there. It's still got to be with respect, but it's got to be there, right? He tells such a funny story, I'll just share with you. He says that he entered into some sort of arrangement with some other families when he had young children, that had like a babysitting swap. So what they would do is once in a while, a bunch of families would drop their kids off at one of the group, and the rest of the group would go out for dinner or something, like, you know, the married couple, so that they have their kids babysat. So he says one time a new family joined, and he says they had a very a strong boy of two who he didn't know, he was unfamiliar. So the father says to him, this is Jordan Peterson, the father says to him, he won't sleep. After you put him to bed, he will crawl out of his bed and come downstairs. We usually put on an Elmo video and let him watch it. So he's thinking to himself, he says, there's no way in the world that this kid is coming down. I'm going to put on any video for him. He goes to sleep, he's going to sleep, right? So he didn't say anything, of course. And the parents went, and that's it. Okay, 2 hours later, it was time to put the kids to sleep. He says, 4 of the 5 went promptly to sleep, but not this little kid. So he said, first of all, he placed him in a crib. He thought, well, a crib, he can't escape from that, right? But of course that didn't work because the kids started to howl, right? So he says that was a win for the child, so that was a bit tricky. So he comes into the bedroom and he says, lie down. Well, that didn't work either. So he said to him, look, he doesn't believe in negotiating with very, very young children, which is he's absolutely right. I mean, it's unbelievable. I've heard parents in parks negotiate with 2-year-olds. And it's like you think you're doing a business deal with a colleague or something. It's like unbelievable. I don't think screaming at them is effective, or raising your voice, or being negative or disrespectful, or putting them down, but negotiating with them? Gosh, right? But he says he does believe in a bit of fair warning, so he says, lie down or I'm going to lay you down, which obviously didn't work. So he comes back and he lifts him up, puts him down in the crib, doesn't the kid get up, so he holds him down, and as he holds him down, gently, he starts to talk about him, you're a good boy, you're going to go to sleep, and he talks him through and he comes down, and after a while his eyes close. He had a voice of authority. The kid really quickly found out that there's no way out of this, closed his eyes, and eventually fell asleep. He ends off the story, he says, with the parents came home. The father didn't ask, but he could see that things were different, and he didn't tell, so he left it at that, and they went home. So that's part of the outcome. That's part of the pendulum syndrome of this type of culture that we've created. Part of that also comes with an inability to defer. In other words, because there's kind of a culture where we all know it all, and there's like a sometimes a weakness, not always of course, but there's a weakness sometimes in deferring to someone that might know better than you, have more experience than you. The concept of, we call in Hebrew, of being mekabel, of actually being a receiver, not just a giver, of actually knowing how to take from others advice or good counsel or experienced sort of perspectives, and so on and so forth. So, what's the answer? In other words, how does this all work? What's the Jewish perspective on this? So, one of the ideas we have to understand in terms of exploring the Tiferet approach with this, right, is that controlling someone else is negative, very, very negative. Humiliating someone else is very negative. We've talked about this before. To put other people down, to abuse other people in any way, in any shape or form, is a terrible evil. The Talmud tells us, we've talked about this many times, that to humiliate someone, particularly in public, is compared to murder. And in fact, the Talmud said that it's better to get killed than to fall into a furnace of fire rather than to humiliate someone else, right? That's how strong it is. Because everyone is created B'Tselem Elokim, everyone is created in the image of God, and therefore on that level, everyone is equal. What does that mean, right? So from a Jewish perspective, we learn and we explore, and there's many, many sources that deal with this, is that everyone is equal, but not the same. And not all relationships are the same. And not everyone is equal, that they're friends and buddies. What does that mean? So let's understand what that word equal means. So everyone is equal because everyone has the same soul. Everyone has the same intrinsic value, right? There's an intrinsic value which every human being has, which is absolutely identical. You know where you see this? You see this in a fascinating Jewish law, right? In the laws of Shabbat, where there are many things that we can and many things we can't do, so we know that in cases of pikuach nefesh means when it's a matter of life and death, when someone's life's at danger, so we break all laws of Shabbat in order to save a life, right? Which life? Any life. So it makes no difference if the life we talk about on Shabbat is a life of a two-day-old infant, or a 99-year-old frail, semi-unconscious person who doesn't have much quality of life, but you could give him a bit of extra life, right? From a Jewish perspective, that's a very important part because life has an intrinsic value. Or a highly functional middle-aged professional, it makes no difference. Absolutely no difference. There's no differences in the laws of Shabbat of how you break Shabbat for a person that only has days to live, or an infant that has a whole life ahead of them, or someone who's very, very accomplished and saving the world. No difference. Why? Because there's no difference. Because the intrinsic value and the intrinsic life of every single human being, from a Jewish perspective, is absolutely sacred. In fact, it's not for now, but it makes a very, very fascinating discussion in Jewish law about triage. Like what happens if you're in a hospital? What happens if you're a doctor? And there's an accident, there are two people, and you cannot treat both of them, right? So who do you treat first? Sometimes it comes down to saving one over the other. What do you do? It's a very, very fascinating topic. Because it's definitely not, one thing it isn't defined by is who's got more years or who's got more capability, who will accomplish more. That doesn't play a role in the equation at all. One of the things that comes into the equation is a concept, I'll just share this one point with you, is a concept in halacha called lefaneinu. Lefaneinu means what, like if two people are in life-threatening situation, have had an accident, someone's a doctor, cannot treat both, there's no one around, you can only treat one. But they're lying, let's say, in two different positions and he's closer to the one. So Jewish law would dictate he's got to treat the one closest to him. Even if that person is a very, very old person, only has a short time to live anyway, and the other person is a younger person, has less to live and can accomplish much more, it makes no difference. Why? Because intrinsic life is the same. If you have to choose, you have to choose. So there have to be criteria. There have to be definitions. One of the definitions is lefanein. If it's right here, then you can't bypass a mitzvah. So if it's right here, you can't choose to say, well, that life is worth more, because that life is not worth more. Every life is worth the same, right? Very, very... can be a very deep ethical and difficult discussion sometimes in different situations. But that's the point. And therefore, because everyone is equal, every single human being, no matter who they are, no matter who's responsible for them, no matter who's their authority or not their authority, every single person deserves dignity and respect. Because they have a soul, they're created in the image of God, and their intrinsic value is identical. Right? However, that doesn't mean that everyone's intrinsic value and everyone's intrinsic worth is expressed and manifested in the same way. It's not. It is the same, but it's manifested and nurtured and revealed and developed in different ways, which therefore results as in different people having different functions, different people having different roles, and it also results in the concept of different relationships operating in different ways. Right? Many, many years ago, we talked about this. It's a term that I like using just to explain it. For example, in relations, in a very general way, every relationship has to be a mutually respectful relationship. It doesn't matter what kind of relationship it is, but there are two kinds of relationships. There's what we call horizontal relationships and vertical relationships. What I mean by horizontal relationships is like marriage, where two people are equal, relating to each other, but then there are horizontal relationships, for example, teachers and students, parents and children, seniors and juniors, right? At work, for example. Where there, it's a horizontal relationship, which means even though there has to be mutual respect, but one defers to the other. Because one is senior, and one has authority, and one has responsibility. And therefore, if you look in Shulchan Aruch, if you look in the Code of Jewish Law, we've talked about this once before as well, where we learn, where it's very, very clearly outlined, the laws of respect. Now, respect is a very general word, and respect has to be there with all relationships. Doesn't matter. But the laws of specific laws of respect, when it comes to horizontal relationships, they're unbelievably strict. Unbelievably strict. You know, on Yom Kippur, I once had a discussion with someone, and you know, on Yom Kippur, there's a confession list that we do in the process of doing tshuva, right? One of them is we ask Hashem forgiveness for not... For mishandling or disrespecting parents or teachers. And someone's asked me, like, why do we single this out? So the commentaries say, have a look in the Code of Jewish Law about how you're supposed to respect parents, and you'll see that we all have what to do tshuva for. We all have what to improve, right? Because it's very, very strict, very strict. How you talk to them, and you're supposed to interrupt them, and getting up for them, and not sitting in their place. All these kind of things, very, very specifically prescribed and outlined. Why? Because that's the nature of relation. Why? Because part of personal growth is that we go beyond ourselves. You see, the way a person grows is that not to remain stuck in who we are. So therefore, the way we grow is we have to learn to go beyond ourselves. Part of the process of going beyond ourselves is self-control, is boundaries, is rules, is deferring and learning and sometimes surrendering to the authority and or the positive control, I should say, or guidance of someone older, more senior, and that's the way children grow. Now, that doesn't mean that the respect is not supposed to be there from the senior to the junior in horizontal relationships. Parents have to respect children too, but it has a different translation. When parents respect children, it means giving them dignity, it means not humiliating them, it means not screaming at them and calling them bad, but rather pointing out where they could improve. There's lots and lots of ways and requirements of how parents or teachers can respect children, or in the world relationships at large, how older people can respect younger people, and how people in senior positions can respect people who are in lower positions, and so on and so forth. But it's a different type of respect, because part of growth is that there should be in the world horizontal relationships, which horizontal relationships means that we surrender a little bit, and that sometimes we listen even to things that we don't understand or we don't agree with, but there's that going beyond ourselves. Sometimes we have to learn to do things we don't understand. Sometimes we have to surrender to the guidance or the instruction of someone who don't understand what they're doing. That's part of growth. It's not an oppression, it's part of growth. And it's part of growth which doesn't affect in the slightest the concept of everyone being intrinsically equal. Because everyone is intrinsically equal. But still, the way that develops and the way that has to be nurtured is different for every person. Right? And that's the concept of Tiferet, where Tiferet means that you have to combine both ideas. See, equal means everyone connects with each other, but connection, and every relationship has to have the element of connection. Every relationship needs love in that particular subject to the context of that particular relationship. Because a teacher and a student, for example, is only effective if there's a bond between them, there's some sort of relationship there, right? Not just a cold, distant relationship. There has to be a kind of a connection. That connection is chesed. But sometimes relationships also need gvura. And gvura means boundaries. Gvura means standing back. Gvura means surrendering. Gvura means knowing where to stop and knowing our place and knowing our role, right? So when we move away from one extreme to another, going back to the context we were talking about, when society moves from inequality, abuse, control, harshness, negativity, from a much, much more accepting, equal society, the problem is when you move to the other extreme and you go to the other end of the pendulum, where we lose the gevura. There used to be only gevura, now there's only chesed, but that's a problem, because there becomes a lack of learning from others. There becomes a sense of entitlement, a lack of responsibility, becomes a lack of respect for authority, and it's problematic. Right? Now, a person who's in a position of authority has to know not to abuse that. That's true. But one thing has nothing to do with another. A great leader is one who doesn't abuse authority, who doesn't abuse control, doesn't use control. But an effective person who grows is someone who can respect authority, who can respect learning from someone else. Which, by the way, isn't only true with horizontal relationships. It's not true only with vertical relationships. I used the wrong word before. Sorry. It's true with horizontal relationships too, right? Now, it's certainly true with vertical relationships where there's up and down, but it's also true with any relationship, because in every relationship, even equal ones, even horizontal ones, there's what we call a mashpia makabel. Each person has to give and each person has to receive, and we have to recognize within the other person what that person has that we don't have, and learn from it, and receive it, and respect it. And that person does the same to us. But that's also part of learning how to surrender sometimes to an opinion of someone else. We might recognize in someone else that they know more about a certain topic or about a certain experience than we do. It's that concept of saying, well, I know I feel a certain way, but I can leave myself. I can listen to you because I know you're more experienced in that field. That concept of giving and receiving in both, right? So we talk about education, for example, or any relationship. We talk about the concept of empowerment today, right? Now, empowering someone else is very, very, very important. But again, not to the extreme, because at the same time when you empower someone, especially when it's a parent and child or teacher and student, there also has to be the boundaries and the rules, which sometimes looks like not empowering them. It looks like you're controlling them. But that's important because certain people have a responsibility to do that. Again, it's that balance of bringing both things together. You know where you see it, interestingly enough, also, and I'll just share with you an interesting idea. Again, also, it's sort of the pendulum also swings in this. Like, in education today, in teaching, but it's true in all forms of education, there's a greater emphasis on empowerment in education. What I mean by that is not spoon-feeding people knowledge, but getting them to understand how to learn for themselves, right? Which is a great thing. However, again, there's also the same pendulum effect, where today there's some kindergartens that run like that, where they're letting kids choose what to learn. It's like a new Meshagas, so they call it Yiddish, right? Like some of it comes from the Montessori and other methods like that, which are good models, but they, when taken to an extreme, they're just ridiculous. I've never heard of asking a three-year-old what they want to learn, right? And in fact, it's completely contrary to Jewish thought. And I'll explain to you why. You know, it's amazing. I once gave a talk. I just did it recently again. You know, it's just an interesting thing. I know not everyone is educators, but it's an interesting thing. It's interesting how sometimes modern psychology sort of or theories and things like that, it's interesting to test them against ancient Jewish sources, right? So when I was learning education, of course, I learned about Piaget's stages of cognitive development, which means essentially that every child develops at a different stage, and there are different windows that open and shut at different stages of your learning experience, right? So without going into the details, for example, at a young age, children are much more concrete, but so they don't really have the capacity to understand nuances of things or to think abstractly. They're more concrete. They think like in black and white. However, at the same time, that's a tremendous strength, because children, for example, have an amazing memory, which an amazing also memory for language, which older people don't have. So, for example, a very simple thing: if you move country and you move to a place that speaks a different language, your 4-year-old will pick up the language in 10 minutes, and unless you're particularly linguistically talented, you'll still be battling after 10 years, right? So that's how it works. Why? Because although I can think, I can understand things deep on a deeper level than my five-year-old grandchild, but language they can pick up better than I can, because the brain opens and shuts at different stages in different ways. So it's interesting that the Talmud already spoke about this in many places. And the Talmud, in one particular place where it talks about the development of the school system, which was in the Talmud, was attributed to a great rabbi called Rabbi Shua ben Gamla, who instituted in Jewish communities the idea of early childhood schooling, like primary school, in other words. So he actually, because there wasn't, until he came along, it wasn't. Fathers just used to learn with their children, and it wasn't so effective always. So therefore, he developed a school system, particularly in primary level. So the Talmud says two fascinating things. The Talmud says, first of all, that formal classrooms should start at around the age 6 or 7. That's what the Talmud says. And the commentaries say, why 6 or 7? So this is also an interesting thing, because we know now that children develop even at the stages of cognitive development, but each child is different. Not every child reads the books, right? Not every child knows exactly what age they're supposed to kick into a particular way of learning, and different children develop in different ways. Different children become ready for reading at different stages, and so on and so forth. So the Talmud says 6 or 7, because it depends on the child. You have to also individualize it a little bit. But then the Talmud says, okay, it's around the age of 6, formal classroom, that's where you start teaching Chumash and Tanakh and so on. And the Talmud has an amazing expression. The expression is, safale katura. At that age, take them into the class and stuff them like an ox. Now, what does that mean? Sounds a bit harsh. What does that mean?
No. Like a
right. In other words, at that age, they are sponges. At that age, because in different place, the Pirkei Avot, the Talmud says that there's Gemara learning, Talmud learning. Talmud learning is more abstract, it's in-depth analysis. That, according to the Pirkei Avot, should be much later. What do you do when the child is young? Just fill the database, right? Give them knowledge, because like a sponge, just let them absorb facts. Because if they absorb facts, then later on they can use the facts to compare, to analyze, to synthesize, to in-depth comparison, analysis, and so on and so forth. But they can't do that. They can't do that at 6 and 7. At 6 and 7, what they can do is much more than a 15-year-old or 20-year-old. They can absorb facts. So just build the database, right? So I'm thinking that's an incredible balance. The Talmud says that the greatest thing you can do afterwards is for independent learning. That's true. There's nothing better in education for a child to learn on their own, but not as an obsession that's now it's become such a craziness. That they have this all these methods where seriously, I mean, I know it's my own grandchildren. That's like a ridiculous thing where they take little kindergarten ages and like 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, and they decide, what do you want to learn today? We'll develop a curriculum around nonsense. Chuck it all out. Just make a curriculum what you think children need to learn at that age and teach it to them and finished. They'll be fine. They won't sue you for trauma afterwards. I promise, right? Yes, you want to ask something, sir. Yeah, you good? Again, sorry?
They'll sue you for entitlement.
Well, they won't. Actually, thank you, but that's a separate issue. So it's very interesting because in the Torah we find a very similar thing. We know that in the Torah there are 613 mitzvot, right? Now, we just had this actually last week's parasha. So some of them have reasons, some of them don't. So different ways to categorize it. So for the purpose of this discussion, let's just talk about two categories of mitzvot. There's some mitzvot which God gave us called mishpatim. Right? Mishpatim. What are mishpatim? Mishpatim are laws that are rational, that have reasons, that can be explained. Some of them are intrinsically rational, so they make sense even if we weren't given the mitzvah, we'd come up with a similar system, like not to steal, not to kill. We hope society sort of normally, naturally sort of arrives. Or they're things that we maybe wouldn't come to on our own, but they're explainable. So God said we should eat matzah on Pesach night because when we left Egypt, it's a symbolism that the Jews were in a hurry, so they didn't have time to bake bread, so they bake matzah. So therefore, when we commemorate the Exodus from Egypt, we eat matzah. There's a reason. It's logical. It makes sense. Okay. Then there are mitzvot, which God gave us in the Torah that don't make sense. They actually don't have any logical reason. Now, there's a whole theological discussion of what that means, but simply what it means is that of course there's a reason. Just God chose not to give us the reason. He chose not to explain it to us. He chose to ask us to do those mitzvot without, just as a simple act of compliance, obedience, subservience, do these mitzvot. And the obvious question is, what does God actually want? How does he want us to serve him? He wants us to serve him to understand what we're doing, or he doesn't want us to understand what we're doing. And the simple answer is he wants both, and that's why he divided the mitzvot like that, right? Because there's a tremendous value in understanding what you're doing. What's the tremendous value? Tremendous value is that when, as this is explained, what the commentaries explain, that when God asked us to serve him, he didn't want us to serve him only with our hands, only externally, superficially. He wanted us to get completely involved. He wanted us to be engaged in what we're doing, right? So the human being operates on many layers. So I'll give you an example. Like if you ask a teenage child to tidy up their room, right? If you're successful and they're compliant, they go and do it, right? So which part of them tidied up the room? Not the head, not the heart, because they really think it's a useless exercise, right? They did it because they had to. So what part of them tidied up the room? The hands. But not the whole of them, right? When you understand what you're doing, and it becomes something you connect to, and it's got an explanation, you relate to it. So therefore, more of you does it. With me? So therefore, God gave us a whole set of mitzvot because he wanted us, and of course, we are the people of the book. What does that mean? He wants us to learn. He wants us to understand. He wants us to be knowledgeable. He wants us to do things and to try as the best we can to understand the significance and the depth and the laws and the ramifications of what we do, because then when we do it, we're doing it with more of us. More of our being is involved in what we're doing, right? But at the same time, he gave us chukim. He gave us mitzvot that don't have any reason. Why? Because part of human growth is understanding that there are things beyond us. Part of human growth is acknowledging the limitation of our own capacity, limitation of the own human intellectual mind. And part of growth is going beyond ourselves, not getting locked in ourselves, as we always speak about. If we only did things we understand, then we would only stop at things we understand, and we'd never be prepared to do anything that we have a question on. And that would stunt our growth, and that would stunt our opportunity for spiritual connection and divine connection. So God gives us also part of the mitzvot that we don't understand. It says, do them anyway, even though you don't understand, because that's good for you. We need to be obedient. We need to surrender to a higher being, because surrender is not a bad thing. Surrender is only a bad thing when you surrender to someone who then abuses it. But surrender is not a bad thing in itself. Surrender means that we're going beyond ourselves. We're going beyond our finiteness. We're going beyond being trapped in ourselves. It's an incredible liberating formula for growth. And that's why the Torah has part of the mitzvot, which are chukim, which are mitzvot without reason, or without little reason, or without a lot of explanation, so that we get used to, and we accustom ourselves, and we train ourselves to do things even when we don't understand them. It's equally important. Again, that concept of tiferet. Explaining it so we understand it, that's a chesed sort of thing, so we connect to it. Obedience is more gvura. We say, defer. We defer to something higher. We'll just do it because you told us to, and you must have a good reason. That's gevurah. The Torah is a combination of both. It's tiferet. Because if you do one or the other, it becomes extreme and it's ineffective. You know, a while ago, I don't know if you remember, many years, I don't know, it was that long ago, but we did, from a Jewish perspective, we did the 7 Habits of Effective Living by Stephen Covey. Right? You remember that one of them is win-win. Right? And it's interesting because if you remember how the habits work, he's got 7 habits. So the first 3 is what he calls the private victory, and the next 3 is what he calls the public victory. Private victory means is you work on yourself before you work on your relationships. Because if you want to be an effective person and have an effective relationship and accomplish and succeed in coming to great solutions and great effective strategies, you first have to work on yourself, which is absolutely spot on. Why? Because the next 3, which he calls the 3 habits of public victory, which essentially is the 3 habits of great effective relationships, are very much along the lines of the Tiferet model. Right? But in order to have that Tiferet model, you have to work on yourself as a person. Because going back to what we started with, in order to have a Tiferet mindset, you have to move away from ego. Because ego is what locks us in to the way we are. Tiferet allows us to go away from who we are and to look what's needed and to apply things that are not us, right? That's what Tiferet is. That's what we've been explaining. So, and that's why it talks about the idea of being in control of our responses, being proactive, having a goal of life, and so on and so forth. Those are those first 3 habits, because we need to work on ourselves first so that we can be in control of our own ego, so we can move to the Tiferet model. And I say that because I was thinking about it as I was preparing this, because his fourth habit, is think win-win, right? And it has this great idea, what does it mean to think win-win? So most people don't think win-win. Most people, particularly in areas of conflict, think win, lose, or lose, win. Right? In other words, most people think I'm going to win and you're going to lose. And I'm going to do whatever it takes for me to what they call in Yiddish firois, which means I'm gonna get to where I want to get, right? I'm going to prevail. Some people, that becomes very impossible, so they go for a lose-win. They become like the opposite. Okay, you know what, have it your way, do whatever you want, I don't care, I'm just a schmata anyways, you know, you always tread on me, so just do what you want kind of thing, right? That's the lose-win model, not very effective either. The win-win model means, he calls it the habit of mutual benefit, right? Which means that you think creatively, or you think beyond yourself, but more important, you stop thinking about winning, because you think about a solution that's going to be beneficial for both of us and respect both of us and not always compromise. Compromise is one way, but he says even more than compromise. Compromise means that we think creatively, we think about what is needed, not so much about what I want, about what you want, but we move to a different solution about how do we get to a point where we do something that's going to benefit both of us. And that mostly, for most people, that takes an amazing, it sounds so simple, but it takes, he has this whole, if you Google it, you'll see, if you YouTube it, you'll see it. Like, he has this whole exercise, I introduce this idea. He calls up someone, he says, we're going to do an arm wrestle, right? So, okay, arm wrestle is I win and you lose, or you win and I lose, right? So he says, he calls up someone and says, okay, there's a panel there. And every time I move your arm down, I get 10 cents. Every time you put my arm down, you get 10 cents, right? So they start the wrestle. He says, sometimes what happens is people are so used to winning and losing, so there's still a struggle. So what he does is he lets the other person just put his arm down and then back and then arm down again and again until the person realizes, of course, because over here we're doing it for a dime, right? So then they just keep on going. Each one keeps on going. So we both get lots of money, sort of thing, right? That's the way he introduces it. But the win-win concept is about moving away from ourselves. So for example, I don't know if you remember the story, but it's a beautiful story. It tells a story of two people coming out of a train, and there was a movable store, a stall that was selling fruit for people coming back from work, and there was one orange left, and they both people coming out of the train simultaneously went for the orange, and it was clear that only one's going to get the orange, right? So one way is to have a fight and say who came here first. The other way is to do a compromise. So the guy can take out a knife, you know, he says, I'll sell you both the orange. I'll cut it in half, you take half, you take half, right? So then he tells the story, he says, no, what happened was that the guy said, can I know why you want the orange? Right? Let's think creatively here. So one guy says he loves orange. And he says to him, so what are you going to do with what you call that stuff? What's the white stuff called? The what? The pith, yeah. Yeah, what are you going to do with it? I'm going to throw it away. He says to the other guy, why do you want the orange? He says, no, I actually don't like orange, but I make an amazing ice cream for which I need the pith, right? He says, oh, fantastic, okay. So why don't you both buy the orange? We'll cut it, we'll take out the orange, give it to you, give you the pith, and take it home. Everyone's happy, right? And a certain mindset. That's this idea of win-win. How do you think win-win? The reason I bring it in is because it only depends on one thing. It depends on not being locked. When we're locked in one extreme, in one mindset, in one obsession, because this is our cause, this is our mission, this is our project, then we move to extremes and we become ineffective. The only way to do it, and all the examples we gave today as well, is to think beyond ourselves. The thing is, what is beneficial? What is going to be effective? And what is effective is always a combination. It's always either a compromise between chesed and gevurah, or it's an extreme combination of chesed and gevurah. Like with the parents. Parents have to love their children tremendously, high dose, but there also has to be rules and boundaries. Like society, people have to be treated with respect. There has to be equality. People have an intrinsic value, but there's still roles, there's still rules, there's still boundaries. It's that chesed and gevurah, and only with the combination of chesed and gevurah can you actually reach an effective way of living. Similar to the education system, similar to the win-win, all these things point in that direction. Next week we're going to put it all together, and we're going to just give a couple of more examples of some ethical dilemmas that also need this kind of deferred mindset to solve. And then, as I said, next week is the last one, and then we're going to take a 2-week break. So we're going to draw the raffle now. Before we draw the raffle, I just want to, as we always do, the last Thursday of June, become a tradition. So the first thing I want to do is, first of all, and I want to do it now, yeah, so. Yeah, we leave it on. Huh? Yeah, stop. So restart now. Okay. So before we start the raffle, I just want to first of all thank a few people. First of all, I want to thank Nechama Lederman is not here, she's overseas, but she always runs the raffle with tremendous, tremendous hard work, and I want to just, in her absence, thank her so much for doing it. I want to thank our dedicated office staff, Yaakov and Michal, who do an amazing, amazing job. Give them a hand, that's it. They do an amazing job in everything, but particularly, especially when we're talking about the raffle, an incredible, incredible job. I want to thank Sylvia Franklin, who helped us out a lot. Mazel Friedman, who volunteered and did a lot of good stuff for us as well in the raffle. But most of all, I want to thank all of you and everyone that bought raffle tickets. I just want you to know what it is. Just before we draw it, the raffle is an important fundraiser for Bina. It has grown every year. This year we sold 100 more tickets than last year, which is really, really good. We've sold over 700 tickets, which is fantastic. And it's just, it's comes along together with Bina's growth in general, which is growing from year to year in all levels. Obviously, it doesn't cover the Bina budget. Our budget is over 800,000, but Bina is very, very busy. But it's a significant part of the budget, thank God. So it does take a good dent into it, and it's very, very much appreciated. So once again, thank you to everyone who participated and supported and is so involved in the Bina activities and in the Bina program. So just to remind you all, this year we worked on three prizes. Going from bottom up, the third prize, which we'll draw first, is a $300 Golds voucher. The second prize is a Westfield voucher valued at $1,000, which was, I just want to thank them, that was donated by Westfield.
We need that.
And the first prize, of course, like always, is two return tickets, to Israel via Korean Air. So we always draw it from the third prize, then the second prize, and then the first prize. Ellie, you want to draw one for us? No? You sure? Okay. So, the third prize, which is the $300, we've mixed it up before, but we'll just give it a good mix again. All right. Okay. So, the third prize, which is the $300 Golds voucher for the 2018 Bina raffle, goes to... Donna, where is she? She left already.
Donna.
Oh, she's right there. Joe Samuel and Donna Del Bar. $300 voucher to Golds. Here we are. Donna, here we are. That's right here. You're here? You can take it.
Thank you, Rabbi.
You're welcome. Enjoy. Someone who loves some good Jewish reading, you'll put it to good use. Okay. The second prize. Let's check again. Oops. Which is $1,000. Oh, no good. Sorry. Thank you. Put it back in. We'll give it another mix. Okay. The second prize, which is $1,000 voucher to Westfield. Is two. Is this one? Or two? Yeah, it's one. Oh, no, it's two. Here we are. Oh, yeah. This is really funny. Goes to Judy Lowy. I'm sure she'll love a Westfield voucher. Okay. Okay. And the top prize, which is two tickets to Israel, goes to Derek Garfinkel. Very nice. Okay. Once again, thank you so much, and thank you all for your support, and have a wonderful week. See you next week.